The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're talking about the healthcare that's practiced outside of big cities and modern facilities. We'll speak to Dr. Sasha Mullally, professor of history and researcher of the history of rural medicine. But first, let's learn how doctors play a role in documenting evidence of torture experienced by immigrants and asylum seekers. I'm here with Aaron Acharya, project manager of the Human Rights Clinic at HealthRight International, and Dr. Gary Stadtmauer, long-term volunteer with HealthRight International and past guest on the allergy episodes of Skeptically Speaking. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Aaron, tell us a bit about HealthRight International.
We are a global health and human rights organization working to build lasting access to health for excluded, underserved communities around the world. We work with local partners in a number of countries around the world on four different issues. HIV/AIDS, TB, and malaria is one. We work on women's health. We work with orphans and other at-risk children and youth. And here at home in the U.S., we work with survivors of human rights violations. And currently we are active in Nepal, Kenya, Vietnam, Ukraine, Russia, and the United States, but before, we have worked so far in about 30 different countries. So we train a lot of community providers, so we build capacity of the local population to provide services to people who are in need.
So HealthRight established the Human Rights Clinic in New York in 1993. Now, what happens there?
In 1993, there was, if you remember, there was this huge crisis at Guantanamo Bay where a lot of Haitian immigrants were trying to make it to the U.S., so the U.S. government was not allowing them to come in, because many of them were HIV positive, and then a group of doctors from Doctors of the World, which was our name back then, went down there, provided evaluations, came back here, became expert witnesses in immigration court, which a federal circuit court, which eventually ordered the U.S. government to allow those people to come into the country. And then later on, this group of doctors realized that there was a huge need for similar kind of services right here in New York, where people needed forensic affidavits, evaluations of both medical, mental health, when they were applying for immigration relief here. So they started doing this sporadic interviews and providing evaluations, but eventually they figured out that this was not something that could last and it was not enough. So Doctors of the World, Montefiore Medical Center, and the North Central Bronx Hospital up in the Bronx collaborated to create the Human Rights Clinic back in 1993. As a residency program in the Department of Social Medicine. So we have a small component that still continues to do the work that was started back then. But since then, the Human Rights Clinic has expanded outside of the Montefiore Medical Center. And we have almost about 250 to 300 active physicians and psychologists and social workers who are our volunteers. We have trained more than 700 people so far to recognize and document signs of torture. And we are active in more than 10 states in the country. Our recent site is Seattle in Washington State. We do four different things. First, we train physicians, psychologists, and social workers to recognize and document signs of torture in people who are applying for immigration relief here in the U.S. And then we train them to write effective affidavits. We have a mentoring system where senior volunteers mentor the incoming new volunteers to do these evaluations. So that's one component of the work, so the training part. The second component, the bigger component actually, is actually doing the work. So we coordinate the evaluations between doctors, attorneys, psychologists, social workers, and clients themselves. So we coordinate about 400 to 450 evaluations each year. The third part is that a lot of these people who are coming here, because they have been tortured, they have medical issues, mental health issues, and like any other immigrant, they do not have any support system in the community. So they need social services, they need help with housing, they need help with clothing. So what we do is we try to connect our clients after the evaluation to medical care, mental health care, and social support. So that's a third component of the work we do. And then the fourth component that we recently have started is what we call the Community Awareness Initiative. We have this 1-hour short trainings about torture survivors and their needs that we provide to local providers. For example, we would go to a hospital or we would go to a clinic. We would go to an organization like Gay Men's Health Crisis. We actually had one there today where we go and talk about torture survivors who are here in your community who could potentially be your clients, but you don't know how to recognize them because they don't necessarily talk about torture. So we teach people through short trainings to recognize torture survivors in that patient population.
So how would a healthcare provider's experience be different working with a torture survivor? What kinds of things would they need to be prepared for?
One of the things, primary things that they should know is that this is a special group of people. They're very vulnerable. They have been tortured by people and they know back home. So they're in a foreign land. They're tortured. They don't speak the language that we speak here. That's one. Two, a normal Sikh patient would talk about the issues they're facing. I have a stomach pain. My tooth hurts. Torture survivors don't generally like to talk about what is happening to them. They have mental health issues. They have PTSD. They have major depression. And they have flashbacks. They're afraid of policemen on the street. All of those things impact their health in one way or the other. But they don't necessarily know how to talk about it. And then second, they can't talk about it because it brings back all those memories. And a healthcare provider has to be very sensitive, very tactical in drawing out the story, not be judgmental, not create a situation where it feels like torture. There are times when a torture survivor might have been tortured by a doctor back in their home country. So you just have to be careful about how you interact with them. The room, the medical examination room, if you block the exit and then if you keep them confined, it could bring back memories and they could be scared. They can't talk. They freeze. So all of these issues come up, which you would not find in a normal patient population.
Now, Gary, you were the lead author of a report titled An Analytical Approach to Clinical Forensic Evaluations of Asylum Seekers, the Human Rights Clinic. Can you tell us about that?
One of the things that I found as a volunteer at first was that despite the wonderful training that I received and the textbooks and articles that I had read, in some ways, I felt that there was a gap in that the descriptions were of classic torture, typical scenarios of torture involving, let's say, electrical torture, suspension, where someone is, let's say, handcuffed and then held up by a rope suspended in midair, beating on the soles of the feet, something known as falanga. These are very, very typical descriptions of torture that you will see in textbooks. But in fact, what you very often encounter with clients that we examine is that the number one experience is that people have simply been assaulted. And in fact, you cannot really predict what someone's experience may have been. Some of the asylum seekers who meet the criteria for asylum under the Convention Against Torture have not really been tortured by, let's say, a military. They may simply have been assaulted by people who were targeting them because they meet the Convention Against Torture criteria, which Aaron can tell you more about.
Convention Against Torture is that you will have to establish that you could potentially be tortured and harmed if you went back to the country you came from. You don't necessarily have to be tortured before. You don't need to have that presumption of torture. But if you can establish enough evidence that there is a high possibility of you being tortured if you went back, there is this percentage thing. A lot of these things are discretionary because in the courtroom it's discretionary relief. But for somebody to apply for CAT, you just have to make sure that you can establish the fact that you could be tortured if you went back. Now, the benefits that you will get here if you get that relief, it's a little different from asylum. It's you can't bring your family here. It's not a permanent thing. You are not put on a path to citizenship. You can just be here, and then you can work until situations in back home change. And then you will be deported, and you will have to go back.
One of the things that you do in the clinic, as you said, is actually evaluate these kind of cases. And there's a number of cases that you write about in the report, and they're all horrific. So basically, in these evaluations, you have to try to figure out if someone's injuries occurred the way that they said they did. Is that correct?
Well, that's part of it. With any patient in medicine, you take a history and you do a physical. And although these people are not our patients, we're not treating them, these are clients, but the approach is the same. You take the history, what happened to you, how did it happen, and you try to match it up with the physical examination. And if the pieces fit together just right, then sometimes the photograph tells the story for you. And there are cases in which someone was burned with an object, and you can really tell that the object was of the shape or diameter that they say it was based on the scar findings, or in fact that they said they were burned with hot iron. And in fact, you can see a virtual tattoo of the tip of the hot iron on one of the clients. It's like a little cross. And so this kind of thing lends credibility to their account. And that's really what we talk about when we talk about the assessment has to speak to some degree about the client's consistency and credibility. And, you know, I think that this is the perfect venue to discuss this because, in fact, I looked through the article earlier today and I knew somewhere in here I would find the word skeptical. And there it was. And the part that is skeptical, though, is that the government's attorneys or those who are interviewing clients are skeptical of their stories. And, right, you know, some right. of this is understandable because, in fact, they see an enormous number of people who are desperate to come to the United States, and frankly, not all of them tell the truth. And so our role is to try to provide something objective, that this is not a story that someone could have made up. And it's also not something, though, where they have to rely just upon our opinion, because I think that's the other element of it. Not only are they skeptical of the clients, but they're skeptical of the fact that, you know, how does a doctor become an expert in torture? Like, what do we know? Right. And in fact, that's why we take the pictures and we try to put the story together in a very neat package. And we say, look, if you look carefully, there is a whip mark. And in fact, you can tell it's a whip mark because there's a little tail at the very end. And that is the transmitted kinetic energy from kinetic into thermal energy, leaving the scar exactly in that pattern. And that is the best way to do things, to allow the client's physical findings to speak for themselves. It takes the subjective out of the equation. It even takes the doctor, who may or may not, in their opinion, be a torture expert, out of the equation.
And that's really the issue with these kind of cases, though. There are potentially so many confounding factors involved in these kind of evaluations. For example, by the time someone makes it to the clinic, the torture could have happened years ago by that point.
And that is usually the scenario. It's very rare to see somebody with acute signs of torture. And usually, these are people who, first, they may not have been able to flee. The torture may have occurred during an extended prison stay, and they may finally be released or bribe their way out or escape and then make their way through a variety of countries and finally enter this country on perhaps a false visa or slip across the border. That's another issue. What happens to people when they arrive here without the appropriate paperwork? Because these people who were once imprisoned in their own countries are then detained here in a detention center that, for all intents and purposes, is a jail.
There's also the issue that sometimes there are no physical scars at all.
That's right. And there is a case in our article that actually it was requested that we add a case by one of the reviewers. In this instance, the client had no scars on his body. However, he told a tale which was so dramatic and so detailed that I was convinced that the only way that someone could conjure this is if they had actually experienced. And his story was that he was a man from Bangladesh who had been assaulted, and he was tied to a tree with his back to the tree, bound by hand and foot, but additionally, there were ropes around his neck, and there was one rope above his larynx and one rope below his larynx. And I simply asked him, well, what do you remember from that night? What did you feel? And I was expecting he might say pain, shortness of breath. He responded, I drooled all night long. Why did he drool? Because his larynx was trapped. And if you just put your hand to your neck and try to swallow, you'll feel your Adam's apple, your larynx moving up and down. And I put that in my affidavit, that really I did not think, in my opinion, as a physician, that anybody other than the person who had experienced this would be able to conjure it. And in fact, when I give trainings to doctors who we train to become forensic examiners, I invariably present this case. I ask around the room, what do you think this person felt? Only twice have our trainees come up with the correct answer. And ironically, those two people were not physicians, they were psychologists, whatever that means.
Interesting.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to Aaron Acharya, project manager of the Human Rights Clinic at HealthRight International, and volunteer doctor Gary Stettmauer. So what about refugees that don't go to New York? How is the evaluation process different for something like this when it's being done by someone who isn't trained in how to look for evidence of torture?
Very, very few people get to our clinic. Very few of those who need these services. All of the people, the clients that come to us, torture survivors who come to us, come through their attorney's offices. So first they will come here somehow to this country, and then they will have to figure out how they are going to sustain themselves when they are going through these legal processes. They will have to find a community, and then eventually they will have to find an attorney, a legal representative, to do their case for them. And then when the lawyer gets their case, and then if the client is able to tell them that he or she has scars or has mental problems or has been tortured before, and then the attorneys will refer them to us. Very, very few people get attorneys, so they don't even get through that first step. So it's a very small number of people who can actually make it to us. Most of the time when clients contact us, we are able to provide the services or are able to refer them out to some of our partners in the local areas where we are not active. We rarely have to say no to clients who actually fit into our funding criteria that's required. So we do provide the treatment, care and the evaluations to those who get to us. But the concern is that there is a huge number of people who don't get to us. And there are some attorneys who don't know about us, but they know that they will need an evaluation. So sometimes they try to get it from private providers. One, it's very, very expensive to get those things. Two, the doctors are not trained. The psychologists are not trained in writing affidavits. So they basically write a forensic report as they would do a clinical report.
Right.
And that may not be essentially a good document for the court if the attorney is not a good person, good at helping the doctor and the psychologist write it. So they're not trained. That's something they don't know. The other thing they would not know is they don't know the asylum laws. They don't know what the judge would be looking for. They don't know what the asylum officer would be looking for. There will be inconsistencies within the affidavit if you don't have a clear eye for those kind of things. If the attorneys don't do a good enough job of reviewing those, then the affidavit is not good enough. With the Human Rights Clinic here, the staff will review the affidavit the doctors provide. If the doctor is new, then a senior mentor will review those affidavits before they even get to the Human Rights Clinic. And then we review it. And then the client's attorney will actually at least have a one look at it. So there are a few people who are reviewing your affidavit, making sure that you are not overstepping your boundaries, making sure that you are covering all of your steps. So those things are not available in the community. So that's tough. The second part of it is that those who don't come to New York, for example, the Human Rights Clinic is active down in D.C. metro area. We have operations in Phoenix, Bay Area, and Seattle. But there are places in the country where there is a huge immigrant population, and then there are many asylum seekers, but there are no torture treatment centers, and there are no providers who are trained. For example, Washington State does not have a single torture treatment center. There are about 17 to 20 funded treatment centers around the whole country, and in places like Texas, which has a huge immigrant population, there is no one. In Phoenix, Arizona, all of Arizona, there was no one until the International Rescue Committee started a small torture treatment program a year ago. So it's tough. There are no resources. People have a very hard time to come by these things.
And just to be clear, if the person who's doing the evaluation doesn't find evidence, a refugee could be deported.
Not always. the attorney is supposed to be putting together a huge packet of evidence. So they will have country conditions experts about human rights situation back in the country when the client was tortured. And now there are other experts. The client himself is an expert. There are other witnesses like character witnesses. There are people like situation witnesses. So our affidavits are critical, but they are a small component of a big case. So the attorney is pretty much putting together the whole play, and then our volunteers provide critical evidence. Sometimes our volunteers' affidavits are the only evidence they have, so that's when it becomes very critical. Sometimes their affidavit supplements and corroborates what the client is saying. They may sometimes have medical records from back home. A judge does not know how to read them, so our volunteers include those things into their report. So sometimes our volunteers provide extremely critical evidence without which there is a possibility that the client could be deported. Sometimes they will corroborate the evidence they already have. Lately, there have been situations where the judge from an immigration court would tell an attorney, go and get a physical affidavit, go and get a mental health affidavit from Health Rights. So attorneys come back from the courtroom. So in those cases, the judge is actually really looking for what our volunteers have to say about it. So that could affect the decision, whether they are granted or asylum or whether they are deported. That affidavit could actually make a difference there.
And how many people have been through the Human Rights Clinic?
So far, we have seen more than 3,500 clients in the last almost 15 to 18 years. As of now, we are seeing about 420, 450 clients a year.
You guys are amazing. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
And you can read about the work of Health Right International at healthright.org or at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with an interview on rural medicine after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
My guest today is Dr. Sasha Mullally, professor in the Department of History at the University of New Brunswick. Her research investigates the social history of rural medicine and medical practices in Canada and the U.S. She's published articles in the Journal of Canadian Studies, the International Journal of Heritage Studies, and she's currently working on her first book, Unpacking the Black Bag. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Desiree. I'm delighted to be here.
So the social history of rural medicine, now that sounds very specific. How did you decide on that as the focus of your work?
Well, Desiree, I grew up in small town Prince Edward Island, and I grew up in a particular context where oral history was a very important part of community life. And there were all of these tall tales associated with a local country doctor. His name was Dr. Gus MacDonald. Gus is short for Augustine. And he was locally famous as sort of a character, but also someone who was very much a part of the firmament of small town life, someone whose medical practice was varied and it was interesting. And he actually has a famous story associated with him. He sewed a pair of feet back on a young boy who had his feet cut off in a threshing accident. This would have been around 1908. And because of this successful surgery and because of all sorts of other things that he accomplished over his career, and because of the fact that he stayed in my small town his entire life and his entire career, he really became a very important person locally. And so I suppose I started graduate school in the mid-90s, and I was kind of feeling around for a topic that I thought would be interesting, would speak to sort of the social history of medicine and health, which was a field that I was interested in. And I kept coming back to this story of Dr. Gus, and this led to this led to a deep interest in the sort of grassroots small town stories about country doctors like him that I could collect across Canada and the US.
So when you say small town, we are talking about rural, or does rural mean something else in your study?
Well, rural has to be defined, I guess, in the context of the day. When I say small town, I mean rural. I grew up in it would really be called a village by most people's estimation, I think, in North America. There were about 2,000 or 3,000 people in Surrey, Prince Edward Island, my hometown. And that town is the basis of a sort of a big sort of rural area in eastern Prince Edward Island. And so when I seek out stories like this elsewhere, I look for similar contexts. I look for physicians who simply call themselves country doctors. I look for individuals who practice in what we would think of as remote regions of Canada. But I focus, I should say at the outset, that because I'm from Maritime Canada, I have focused a lot of my research on the Maritimes and Northern New England, which is where I've collected, simply because this is where I live, some of the richest stories about rural medicine in the early 20th century.
Now, you say that health and location are interrelated.
I do. I think the place is a very important category of analysis if you want to understand not just how medicine is going to be delivered, but what kind of specific challenges will be faced by healthcare by practitioners in any given field. So, for instance, people who live in or physicians who service people who live in Maritime Canada and Northern New England, of course, will have winters with quite a bit of snow. they will have to navigate a lot of ocean travel normally to get to some of the more remote communities in our part of North America. The socioeconomic status of people and their class background will play a very important role in determining how the physician will be required to manage his or her economy and his or her practice in these contexts. So you have to sort of think about the landscape, you have to think about the geography, you have to think about the weather, you have to think about what people do for a living. In the province of New Brunswick, where I teach currently, of course, you have the reality of biculturalism as well. So you have a French-English reality, and you will be required to service people in both kinds of communities, depending on where you live within the province. So that's what I mean when I say place is very important in the delivery of healthcare services.
And doctors in rural areas really do have to be generalists, don't they?
They do. Now, I look specifically at physicians who practiced, quote unquote, before the age of miracles. These are physicians for whom antibiotics was an enormous revolution when it first became available in the form of sulfa drugs in the 1930s. These are doctors who would have practiced before 1950, and so they wouldn't have had benefit to, many of them wouldn't have benefited from state health insurance systems of any kind. And they really practiced with a lot of their attention focused on their, on the community in which they found themselves. And so I guess all that to say, they took a lot of their cues from their environment, from the people in their community, and the memoirs that I study as I develop my historical analysis of this really spend a lot of time sort of talking about relationships and spending a lot of time describing the weather and the geography, and that struck me very strongly.
Yeah, I don't believe that happens with city doctors.
Perhaps not, although I think the socioeconomic status of patient groups is always a reality for any kind of healthcare practitioner. You know, I do think that that there are just so many more layers of place, if you like.
I like that. Layers of place.
I like that too. I actually might use this as I revise my final copy of my book. But there do seem to be a lot more factors that throw themselves up as elements of consideration for these physicians.
Maybe give us some examples of the kinds of cases that rural doctors would see that maybe are different from city doctors.
Well, there's a very well-known story associated with a physician named Carlton Lamont McMillan. He's a very well-known physician who was based in Bedeque, Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. From, I think he started his practice, it was the late 20s, I think it was 1927, and he practiced well into the 1950s, a very well-known doctor. Anyway, there's this story associated with him where he, after, you know, there was a woman who went into labor in a very poor town, or she herself was poor. The town itself was on the west coast of Cape Breton in a place called Inganish. She went into labor with twins, and she was to be delivered by a midwife who found that the case was simply not progressing, and she couldn't manage the case by herself. One of the twins was being birthed breech, it seems, by the accounts of the case. In any event, it was, I think, late winter at the time, and the physician simply couldn't get up to Inganish in time by boat, couldn't get up by car or horse and buggy or horse and sleigh. So he got a member of the Cape Breton Flying Club to commandeer a plane and fly him up to
Inganish. Nice.
Well, it was apparently quite an adventure because the pilot, for some reason, was flying very low. And the physician in his memoirs talks about, you know, the plane hitting the tops of the trees as they fly up through the boreal forest of Cape Breton up to Inganish to deliver these babies. Anyway, he gets there and he delivers the babies, and everything turns out fine. Interestingly enough, there are two narratives associated with this heroic tale. There's one that goes to press where, you know, this tale sort of wraps up with the successful delivery of the babies. The midwife was present. She wraps the babies who were born a little premature in milk boxes and names them Borden and Carnation after the milk brands.
That is painful.
And then everything is lovely. However, in the physician's more candid personal notes, which as a historian you are obliged to read and read very carefully, you learn that the babies don't survive. You learn that the physician, to his chagrin, finds himself out of pocket for this heroic flight up north, despite the fact that it was extremely uncomfortable and he felt like he was going to fly out of the plane himself at any minute. And you learn that the mother, who was apparently a ward of the town, or she was receiving some kind of relief from the town of Inganish, was unable to get from the community sort of any real compensation for the physician for this protracted sort of service that he delivered. And you learn that this was part and parcel of what he was expected to provide for communities like this one, and for women like this in rural Cape Breton. So I guess that is a good example of the ways in which geography, weather, socioeconomic status can come together to create a particular kind of environment and a particular set of challenges for physicians like him. Not that he experiences every day, but certainly his career and the career of doctors like him were peppered with these kinds of episodes that I think can be very telling when you want to understand the contours of rural medicine, you know, before 1950, especially.
See, this leads me to ask, though, about the quality of care that people are receiving in rural areas compared to larger towns.
Well, you know, certainly at the time, the way that his memoirs are framed for publication, and this is not something the physician had control over himself, I should add, because I've looked at the stories that he created, for instance, and how the stories that physicians like him have created, and then what is ultimately packaged and sold to us as sort of heroic country doctor tales, they can often be quite divergent in what the messages that they're trying to convey. And often when you hear stories about country doctors, or you think of these avuncular senior male physicians who become part of small town life and have birthed all the babies in a community for 20 years, I mean, you have this sense of someone who is up to any challenge. You have a sense, and they are often depicted as people who are simply so wise and so schooled in a sort of horse sense brand of medicine.
Right.
They have seen so much, and they are such polymaths, I guess, in their profession, that they can be relied upon to deliver some kind of quality of care no matter what happens. Actually, in their own narratives of practice, physicians express deep dismay with the conditions that they are forced to deal with and some of the challenges that they are forced to contend with over the course of their lives and careers. Certainly the story that I've mentioned about Dr. McMillan flying up to Inganish, this is a lovely story, but he's also the kind of physician who celebrated every mile of hard surface road that was paved in Cape Breton over the course of his career. He didn't wish to, have to fly places in inclement weather. And a lot of these doctors who I've studied, they become a part of community endeavors to build small rural hospitals to try and offset some of the access to healthcare issues that become an endemic part of the practices that they they're part of. Yeah.
We have a question from Jean.
There seems to be a widespread societal distrust of doctors. Are rural doctors in the same boat, or are they given more credibility in smaller communities?
Well, I don't know if I can speak to that in the contemporary context with any degree of confidence. But what I can say is that as a historian, my research speaks to and it's reflecting on and it's trying to respond to something called the Golden Age of Medicine. It's this construct or this idea that physicians who practice before a lot of the therapeutic, technological, and economic elements of contemporary healthcare practices were in place. So before we had a third-party payer system, before we had healthcare that was paid for by the state, before we had antibiotics, before we had a lot of the technologies like X-rays, CAT scans, blood tests, all of these things that we take for granted today, somehow practiced in a way that made them closer to their patients, and that they enjoyed a certain closeness, a certain kind of relationship. And because they weren't reliant upon technologies, they were invested with a lot more of the faith that we now invest in technology.
Interesting.
Well, I mean, this is the idea that goes along with this construct of the Golden Age of Medicine. It's sort of associated with the interwar period, so, which is to say the 1920s and the 1930s, the 1940s, sort of before the economies of medicine become so vast and complex. There's this point at which doctors get a lot of cultural capital, and they get a lot of, they're the most admired sort of profession in North America. I find this actually to be extremely, I find this to be a rather problematic assessment. I don't entirely buy it. I think that we've always been very healthily skeptical of professionals who come into our midst sort of promising to deliver services, et cetera. I think there's a lot of nostalgia and perhaps politicized nostalgia at play in the social construction of these country doctor archetypes, especially when they're depicted as larger than life characters who are capable of all these wonderful things, when they're sort of defined as heroic individuals. These are not depictions that they themselves often cultivate, but that's sort of foisted on them, perhaps in response to community anxieties about these real problems of access to care, in sort of response to the realities of like not having enough money, not having enough access to services. Maybe there's a tendency to put more faith in the individual who you know eventually will show up in an airplane and deliver the babies. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about the psychological process there, but there does seem to be a link. But I do think that in retrospect, there is this very interesting tendency in North America to look at this particular kind of rural doctor, a country doctor, and invest them with all sorts of qualities and capacities that, and that's an interesting process in and of itself. And as a historian, I think part of my job is to unpack this, to unpack the black bag.
Right.
But then also to draw attention to what I believe to be the real qualities that allow this to happen. Sort of the more mundane qualities, like the altruism that is really a part of a lot of successful country doctor careers. I think a lot of the extroverted way that they live their lives in communities and in service to communities, there are some very interesting cases of people who were very much sort of people of people of their places and gave their whole lives to place, the ways in which they really did care about relationships as they delivered healthcare over 30 years in a given small town, these are very interesting elements of practice that I think are a way that I think allow or encourage us to invest all these other things.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Dr. Sasha Mullally about the social history of rural medicine. One of the things that I find really interesting about the way that rural doctors practice is something that you call medical pluralism. Can you explain what that means?
Right. Well, medical pluralism refers to, in a very basic and general sense, it refers to the ways in which these physicians were forced to act as polymaths, as I said before. They were generally coming into communities as young men where there were a lot of social, cultural, and sometimes therapeutic expectations made of them. And what you find in these narratives is, from my perspective, a surprising degree of accommodation to other kinds of healing traditions, other kinds of practitioners, in ways that you would not expect if you were simply following along with the sort of normal historical understanding of profession building that goes along with sort of 20th century medicine. We have this notion that orthodox medicine, you know, sort of scientific medicine, simply becomes ascendant in the 20th century, and we all sort of buy into scientific medicine in very unproblematic ways. But a lot of the physicians who I've studied, particularly, let's turn our attention to northern New England, sort of on the American side of the border, what we would call sectarian medical practitioners or alternative medical practitioners or complementary medical practitioners, and I'm talking about chiropractors, osteopaths, homeopaths, these people held a place within the medical marketplace of many rural areas of New England well into the 20th century. And in fact, osteopathy remains a very important part of healthcare service delivery and general practice throughout the United States. And so I find that a lot of the country doctors who I study on both sides of the border, but particularly in the U.S., embrace medical pluralism in ways that I found surprising. So they would work with osteopaths. Some of them would engage in some osteopathic methods.
Really?
As they do healthcare. Yeah. And these kinds of, you know, different kinds of healthcare practitioners were often in competition with one another. And so you expect there to be more antipathy. You would expect there to be more conflict, and you would expect one kind of practitioner to badmouth the other kind of practitioner. But actually, there's a lot more collaboration and cooperation than you would perhaps expect. Now, on the Canadian side of the border, I've come across documents held by, for instance, the College of Physicians and Surgeons of New Brunswick that describe a lot of collaboration between midwives and physicians. Not to say that that relationship was always placid and
right.
cooperative, but there are physicians who worked in active collaboration with midwives in New Brunswick who were nominally at least, although this was illegal, nominally at least okay with them using anesthesia in the performance of obstetrics. There were physicians who were more or less okay with there being homeopaths populating the medical marketplace of this sort of regional area, this borderlands region that I study. I found this very surprising. And this is what we mean by medical pluralism. And it persists well into the 20th century, I think, to a degree that we are not, we're not always aware of, or that we don't always appreciate.
What do you think the motivation is behind that, to cooperate that closely?
Well, I think you simply need to deliver healthcare services to far-flung rural areas. You can't manage it on your own, and you're happy to have help. I think there's also a tendency, if you live I don't want to reify sort of stereotypes of rural people as being, you know, kind of get along kind of folks, more so than individuals who live in the city. But if you live in a context where self-help and mutual aid is required of your making a living or your survival in some cases, then this is going to create an environment where, a collaborative orientation is going to get you further in your career. And people tend to think about relationships in terms of what kind of outcomes will be there in a very long-term framework. So they build relationships and they try and maintain relationships, and that simply benefits them in these kinds of environments. And so I think that translates into interprofessional relationships as well.
I find this especially interesting, actually, because from what I understand and from a lot of the shows that we've done here on Skeptically Speaking, some traditional medical practices, they don't work, is the thing. So, and of course, that's why we do have modern scientific medicine. So how do doctors integrate practices that aren't effective, but that the patients still put a lot of stock in?
Well, this brings to mind an interesting story from the South Shore of Nova Scotia. There's a physician, there's a whole family of physicians. Their last name is Farish, and they've left behind all of these documents that I've been through. They practiced out of Yarmouth, which is sort of in one of the southernmost towns in Nova Scotia. There was one of the elder Farish physicians talks about these patients who just kind of arrive every spring demanding to be bled. So they get what they described as spring feelings of restlessness and agitation. And they presented themselves at the physician's door wanting, looking for phlebotomy. You know, they simply want their system sort of cleansed. and bleeding was a part of it. And the physician simply accommodated them because this was societal expectation. He didn't think it did any harm. And the Hippocratic Oath starts with, first of all, do no harm. And for some reason, this physician also approached this request with a certain degree of humility, I recall from his narrative. He said that, and who knows, if this is placating or offering some kind of therapeutic benefit to the restlessness that is accompanying their experience of spring, who am I to jump in and say that, well, with my superior understanding or training in the face of 20 or 30 of you, I know better as to what you need or what you need to sort of get over, to sort of embrace the sort of spring tonic that, that the people of this part of Nova Scotia seem to desire. So I think that a clever country doctor, physician who found him or herself in this kind of environment would take a rather eclectic approach to medical practice. And would probably not participate in anything that went against their training in a dramatic way, but was very open to the idea that there was more to learn in heaven and earth than what you learned in medical school. And for practitioners who were educated at a certain time, in a certain place, eclecticism was sort of expected, I think, of them in their practices. And that's also something I've noticed.
Well, that's interesting. That makes a lot of sense, because when you live in a small town, if you want a certain service, you can't just Google it and find one in your neighborhood. I wonder if there was actually pressure on country doctors to actually follow through with a lot of these kind of practices that maybe science hasn't shown any evidence for at all.
Potentially. And sometimes they were put in situations where they felt like acting as the heroic polymath made them feel deeply uncomfortable. I mean, I started this interview by talking about this anecdote of this heroic Prince Edward Island physician who sewed a pair of feet back on. He actually didn't sew the feet back on. They were hanging by the Achilles tendon. And they were almost entirely, the boy was very severely injured. And he did reattach the feet, and the boy did walk again. But in later years, when he was asked about this episode and he sort of spoke to it to a number of reporters or sort of interested people who, were interested in his life and his practice, he expressed a very deep ambivalence about the decision to attempt the surgery, because I think it would have been safer for him to simply amputate.
Right.
And sort of move ahead. With that kind of a protocol. There were these kinds of pressures kind of put on rural physicians. Sometimes community expectations would force them into positions where they sometimes acted beyond what they felt would be their appropriate scope of practice. Oftentimes they were inspired by the fact there was no one else around to kind of move outside a traditional sphere of practice and take on surgical feats, let's say, that that would otherwise not be available to them. I don't know.
We have a question from the chat room from Barbara.
Do you think that rural physicians have developed better diagnostic skills because their access to diagnostic equipment and resources is limited?
There is a lot of writing about the diagnostic acumen of a lot of the physicians who I've studied, and that does tend to come up over and over again. You know how they come to play this very important role within the sort of regional medical infrastructure that they become a part of. Country doctors sometimes, you know, they can't do everything, and sometimes they do refer patients to specialists and city physicians. And in that capacity, there is a lot of writing in the narratives that I've studied that praises them for, you know, for being able to take a very, a varied practice, one that, you know, flings a lot of challenges their way, and develop a particularly broad set of skills where they can recognize a very wide-ranging, set of illnesses, and nothing seems to surprise them at the end of their careers. But as to whether or not this is something peculiar to rural medicine, I really can't say. I know that it's part of the narrative of the heroic country doctor to think that what they come across in a rural context would allow them to develop a lot of really acute diagnostic skills. And certainly, if they don't have a lot of technology, for instance, there's one rural physician in northern Maine who could. He could diagnose a whole series of childhood infectious diseases just by, you know, just on sight, or by looking at his tongue, or by smelling the breath and that sort of thing. But I think that has to do with, I think that may also be a part of this, this heroic mythology associated with the country doctor. I think because we may not expect them to be endowed with this kind of diagnostic acumen, and when they perform so admirably in this capacity, maybe because it's surprising, we tend to make note of it more. I'm not sure, but that would be my sort of preliminary thoughts on that question.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Dr. Sasha Mullally, professor of history at the University of New Brunswick. And we'll be right back after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's an hour with Daniel Loxton, editor of Junior Skeptic and author of Evolution, How We and All Living Things Came to Be. Daniel returns to the show to share the reasonableness of weird things, his keynote address from Logicon 2011. Join us for the complete presentation and an exclusive interview about the science communicators who inspired it. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm discussing rural medicine with Dr. Sasha Mullally, professor of history at the University of New Brunswick. Her research focuses on the social history of rural medicine and medical practices in Canada and the United States. Now, Sasha, your current research investigates the role of women doctors in rural healthcare in Nova Scotia and Massachusetts?
That's right. It's a new project that I began just over a year ago.
Why would you narrow your focus to just women doctors?
Well, one of the things that I found very difficult with my first book project was I simply couldn't accept the fact that there seemed to be so few rural women physicians in this region that I studied. Certainly, you could see the names of female physicians in physician registries, but it was very frustrating to come up empty-handed every time I would go into an archive or I would go into some kind of museum, sort of looking for narratives of rural medicine that involved women doctors. They just didn't seem to be extant. I couldn't find the degree of literature or the rich kinds of literature that I was finding about all the men who practice medicine, and I was finding at the same time a lot of biographies from Western Canada, from the Southern United States. You know, other regions in North America seem to produce a lot of interesting, charismatic female physicians who practiced in rural areas and wrote these interesting sort of memoirs, but not in my region. At the very end of my research, when this book was still a PhD dissertation, I did finally find a narrative that was produced by a woman from Western Massachusetts, this very sort of rural area of Western Mass. Her name was Mary Felinda Dole. So I incorporate her into my book. But I became intrigued with her. And what I discovered was a small cluster of women doctors who practiced in rural Franklin County, Massachusetts. At the same time, Desiree, I was doing some research in Nova Scotia, and I was looking through this publication that came out on women graduates of Dalhousie Medical School. It's called Petticoat Doctors. It came out in 1990. It's a lovely sort of biographical sketch of the first, I think it's the first 25 years of women graduates of Dal. And what I noted is that a lot of the women who graduated from Dalhousie University, they had very defined career trajectories. They either went into a specialty, they went to a different region of North America, mainly to Western Canada. When I looked through the biographies looking for country doctors, I could only find five or six. They all had names that are associated with a community called the Foreign Protestants of the South Shore. These are people of German descent who live in and around Lunenburg. And I thought, well, now this is interesting. At the same time I was discovering this little cluster of women doctors in Western Massachusetts, it seems like I was finding a similar little cluster in the South Shore of Nova Scotia. And I thought, well, this is a phenomenon that requires study. So my next project is going to sort of investigate this in a more sort of systematic way. And I would like to know why these two areas. When you have a community that seems to be open to female practitioners, what is it about the community that you know, allows women to flourish in the role of small town GP? Because when I say the term country doctor, usually the image that comes to mind is a very male figure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like it's an older senior. I used the word avuncular earlier, you know, someone who looks like your uncle, your favorite uncle. But he's a male physician carrying a black bag, probably looking tired. You don't think of, you don't think of a woman. And I think that there's an interesting sort of gender element to both the creation of the iconography of the country doctor and then the women who successfully created lives in small town and rural medicine probably have something very interesting to tell us about one of those other layers of place that are very important in determining how a rural medical practice, you know, evolves and is created and maintained.
Well, one thing I found kind of fascinating, actually, is that women seem to organize their practices differently than men.
It seems to be the case that women tend to be more open to group practices, you know, in contemporary medicine. They seem to try and seek work-life balance to a greater degree than many male counterparts, perhaps. They tend to be more open to taking on salaried positions. And these are things that a lot of contemporary researchers have noted in sort of very recent studies of how gender plays out in sort of the career choices of medical physicians. For the pre-Medicare generation of doctors, especially sort of small-town rural doctors, I'm interested to see if this is indeed the case. At first glance, it does seem as though at least three of the physicians who have managed to get a bit of biographical data about in Nova Scotia do seem to practice with husbands, or they seem to practice in tandem with senior male physicians in the region that they find themselves. This also seems to be the case in Franklin County, Massachusetts. Now, the degree to which this is unique to rural medicine, that I don't know yet, but this would therefore be unsurprising that successful women doctors would, despite the fact that they operate as individual and independent practitioners, would nonetheless seek out and build relationships and create sort of de facto group practices before they were the norm in the medical profession. This would explain their presence in these two communities and perhaps elsewhere.
I am absolutely enthralled with this field of study, and we're completely out of time, Sasha. That's...
Okay.
Damn it. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me, Desiree. I was delighted to get the invitation.
You can find Dr. Sasha Mullally at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, why not click the links to Twitter, to Facebook, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to this show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov. out spells, cause we're skeptically speaking. On mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.